Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host Colin Campbell, and today is episode 216 of the podcast, and I'm joined by Chris Merribeal. Chris is the founder and CEO of Novos, a cutting-edge consumer longevity biotech company which is exploring how to live your longest possible life in the best possible way. You can expect to learn about what inspired Chris to go on a lifetime pursuit of true health, staying resilient in the face of really significant health challenges, handling the stress of building and scaling businesses, as well as what are some of the common misconceptions around the emerging and growing field of longevity. It's become a little bit of a buzzword online, and there's a lot of misconceptions around it, and we work hard to address those. Chris's own story is fascinating. Having achieved a biological age 13.6 years younger than his chronological age, he is well positioned to share both actionable and practical advice on how to reverse your aging, including advice on sleep, training, diet, and much, much more. In this discussion, we really do learn how he went about aging 31% slower biologically than he is chronologically, which, if you think about that in percentage terms, is wild. This podcast is not restricted to health and fitness. It is also exploring Chris's insights from a business and a passion perspective as well, and I think there's a lot to learn. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by my podcast, Masterclass. And that feels so cool to say that after the last 3 years of growing this show to the top 1% globally, I'm delighted to have distilled down the lessons that I've learned on how to grow, sustain, and scale a podcast that you can action as well. Now, most podcasts fail. The vast majority don't put in place the processes and the systems and the background, and they also don't allow the host to work on their skill set to really grow into the role. And it doesn't have to be like that. If your goal is to grow something that's really important to you and has an impact on yourself, your business, or whatever else you're aiming towards, I can help you do that. You can build something that's industry or niche specific, and I can support you to do that. It's all about impact and purpose and fulfillment. And I've distilled it down into a really easy to follow 9-module course that's delivered over video. It includes advice on equipment, software, templates for managing and securing the best possible guests, and even my secrets to researching for and preparing for interviews, and even my advice on what are the best questions to ask to delve deeper and get more from your guests. The link is going to be in the show notes. At the time of recording, it is mypodcastmasterclass.thinkific.com, but by the time I've got everything up and running with all my domains, it should be mypodcastmasterclass.com. So if you're listening to this in November 2023, it's likely to be the link that is in the show notes, and you can get involved. Last thing before we hear from myself and Chris is a massive thank you for your continued support of the show. If you're new here, hover that finger and hit that follow or subscribe button on whatever platform you're on, and make sure you've left a 5-star rating if you're a user of Apple Podcasts or Spotify. But that's quite enough for me. You can have an hour and 10 minutes with myself and Mr. Chris Merribeal. Chris, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And when I was thinking about this conversation, I was so intrigued to understand somebody that goes on a mission like yours in terms of your own longevity, but also helping other people with theirs. Where does the interest start to spark a passion like that?
Great question. So my interest in health began when I was just 12 years old. So it actually began in the gym in high school, in elementary school, when we had to do pull-ups, and I was only able to do 3, and some of the classmates of mine were able to do 7 or 8 or 9, and I wanted to impress some of the girls in school. So I started to exercise, and every day I would come home and do pull-ups and try to get into better shape. And so it became something that I was really, I enjoyed very much. And so I integrated the exercise into my daily routine, into my lifestyle. And so it came that much more as a surprise to me when I was 16 years old and I was in New York City on a school trip, and I suddenly started feeling dizzy and nauseous. And next thing I knew, I woke up with blood all over my shirt, laying on the floor. The room was cleared out, and it turned out that I had had a seizure. And I had severed my tongue from biting down on it. And that's why I had blood all over myself. And that seizure was caused by what we would later find out was a brain tumor. So it was all a huge shock to me. I never expected that, you know, of course, when you're a teenager, you think you're invincible, right? Like nothing ever bad is going to happen to you and your health. This is for older people. It's not for young people, right? Especially if you exercise and you're healthy like I was, and I was wrong. It can hit any one of us. And it changed my perspective on life. It dramatically changed my perspective on health. Prior to that, my idea of health was the superficial side. I wanted to be attractive to my classmates. I wanted to do well in sports. That's how I saw health. But I realized that it was a lot more than that. It was about biological optimization and doing everything you could to avoid the diseased state, which could then lead to incapacitating you or even worse, leading to death. And so that's something that it planted this seed in me that I wanted to do everything I could to avoid being on a bed again, contemplating mortality and wondering whether I would wake up the next morning.
On a far less extreme end of the spectrum, so many people that I've spoken to and interviewed have seen the ability to control their health and their fitness as a really empowering feat, and it's led to so many great things. But I completely recognize that having that brush with your mortality at such a young age would have had such a shock to the system. And again, I've interviewed so many people that have maybe been close to that, whether it's been a family member or a loved one or whoever it's been. But for to be yourself at that age, it's such a shake to the core values that you probably hold. And I'm very, very glad that it's put you on this path that not only has helped you, but it's helped others too, which is so admirable.
Thank you. Yes, it has a dramatic, it makes a dramatic change in how you perceive life, at least for me. Like I chose to look at the experience as a gift and to try to derive as much out of it as I possibly could. And part of that gift was in the sense of me looking at, first of all, how fragile life is and how precious it is and the wonderful experiences that we can all have and wanting to do everything I could to make the best of my life. So kind of becoming the pilot of my life and not being somebody who sits back and lets life happen to them, but taking control and creating the life that I wanted for myself. And, you know, on that point of just appreciating life, it was something so I would never expect this. And when I tell people, oftentimes people look at me like I'm crazy saying this, but people who have been through an experience like this, they connect on what I'm about to say, which is I had a deep appreciation for even the pain and the frustration I was feeling after the surgery. So it was a long recovery process. And the fact that I was still alive to experience pain, I never looked at pain or frustration in a way like that. You always look at it as this terrible thing that you want to get rid of. And of course, you don't enjoy the pain. But to be able to take a second to step back and observe it and say, I am still alive to experience this. And that in and of itself is a blessing. Was so foreign to me prior, but it really shaped my perspective on life in a dramatic way. And for that, I'm very thankful.
I think that perspective term is so, so powerful. And it's why people listen to stories like yours. It's why people read books that speak about people who overcome challenges or trauma or stress. And at the very extreme end, one of the most popular books for all of my friends and a lot of my listeners is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
I knew
because
you were going to say that.
It finds that I think a lot of us gym bros associated with that book a lot. And I really believe that when you think about the kind of the depths of struggle that humans can put up with, you can find meaning and purpose and perspective in so many of these things. And when you're lying in that hospital bed and feeling that pain, it sounds grim, doesn't it? But you appreciate that pain more than not being able to feel anything at all and not being able to then impact things in the way that you have done since then.
Exactly. And I was still alive to be able to have a future, to see a vision for what I wanted to make of my life. And the fact that I had this experience, which then transformed my thinking and my perspective, it's not something I would ever wish upon somebody to go through a very difficult experience like this. And there's many other manifestations of difficult experiences, some of which are far more difficult than what I went through. But with that said, having gone through it and making a conscious effort to grow as much as possible and to not feel like a victim, but to feel empowered from the experience, I think is a crucial distinction that typically you actually have to make that decision yourself, that you're going to look at this experience differently, that you're not going to feel like you were victimized by it, but you're going to look at it as a gift and something that you can catapult yourself to the next level of life, if you will, from the experience.
Completely agreed. And so much of the language and the framing we have of events dictates how we feel about it. Like, we have this event and then we have, or the stimulus, and then we have this gap in between what we choose as our response. And in that gap, we can create whatever narrative we want within reason, of course, that allows us to choose a response off the back of it. So what was your recovery like after something as significant as that at such a young age?
Yeah, so the recovery, the most significant part about it that I recall was the difficulty to get back up to speed again, mentally speaking. So I was very slow. So prior to that, I did very well in school. I was in AP courses. It was, you know, school came relatively easily to me. And for the first time, I felt dumb. Like, I literally felt stupid. And I'll give you an example. So I had a tutor that the school generously provided to me to try to keep me up to speed with my classes. And I had a tutor for American history. And the teacher asked me to repeat a sentence that she read to me, literally right after she read it to me. And I was incapable of repeating the sentence. My memory was so shot that I could not even repeat one sentence of words. That's how bad it was. And so that period of me trying to, like, first of all, cope with, you know, it was SAT year. I was a junior in high school. I was in these advanced classes. I didn't want to be held back. Being able to keep up with all of that while struggling so much, it was again another gift, because I saw how, you know, somebody who might have a learning disability the frustration that they might feel when their classmates, their peers are doing well in something. And for me, it had come easily. And now for the first time, I had this humility. I realized I couldn't keep up with others. And it built this degree of empathy for me. There's another experience that I know you didn't ask this, but I think it's relevant to your question. When prior to the surgery, they had to do a number of tests on me. And one of those tests was they sent a tube. This is going to sound crazy, but from my groin up to my brain. And I asked the nurse before they did this, I was like, can't you send it from, like, my nose or my neck instead of, like, going down there? And, you know, as a shy Catholic boy, that wasn't an area that I was expecting, you know, a whole team of doctors to be going
expecting.
Yeah, especially when it was up here and not down there. But anyway, they said, no, that's the only way we can get the tube up without actually killing you. If you went through your nose, you would die. And so I said, okay, fine, let's do it. I didn't know exactly what to expect, but essentially what they did was they sent a chemical through to turn off certain areas of my brain, basically turn off these neurons. And they wanted to see, when they're doing the operation, what areas of my brain they were coming close to, so that afterwards they could do these cognitive assessments and figure out whether I was disabled in one way or another. And so there was a point where, for example, they turned off my speech. They don't tell you what they're going to do. You wake up, and they showed me a banana and they said, what is this? And I'm thinking to myself, do you think I'm an idiot? I don't know what a banana is, because I didn't know what to expect, right? And then out from my mouth came blah, 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 blah. I couldn't say the word banana. And I was shocked. I was so surprised that this came out of my mouth. So I tried again. And I was like, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't actually say a word as simple as banana. And they saw I was getting frustrated. They're like, oh, all right, let's try something new. And they showed me a water bottle and they said, what is this? And again, I couldn't say the word. And that, again, taught me, like, it showed me this other side of reality for other people who have speech impediments, or they have neurological disorder where they can't actually speak, and how frustrating that could be. There was a point where I couldn't see. They turned off my vision. So it was just these crazy things that I was experiencing through this. But it really helped me to have a a taste of what other people are go through day in and day out. And it's their reality for the entirety of their lives. And I'm so fortunate to be, you know, of sound mind and body today. And prior to that, it just really sets everything into context.
It's incredible to see. And I wonder what it says about your personality that you were back bench pressing in your parents' basement not too long after the surgery. I hear that didn't go too well, though.
No, yeah, it did not go well at all. So up to that point, I had not gone more than a week without exercising. Even to this day, other than my experience with the brain tumor, I've never gone more than a week without exercising. And I'm basically 40 years old now. So when I got out, the doctor said, you know, you need to take it easy. You can't exercise for, you know, however long it was. I think it was a month or so. But a couple of weeks in, I'm sitting in the basement of the home I grew up in, and my parents are up in their bed watching TV. And I say, you know what, let's see what I've got. It's only been, you know, roughly speaking, a month or so since I've lifted weights. So I get under the bench press, and it had, I don't know, maybe like somewhere around 200 pounds on it. About, I think that's around 80 kilograms or so. I lift it off and I bring it down, and I can't bring it up, and I have no spot, and I had to like just throw it off of my body, and it landed against the wall. I ripped through the sheetrock, and my dad yelled down, "What are you doing down there?" I was like, "Nothing, nothing, it's fine." And then I tried to cover it up with a painting, like as if my parents wouldn't notice the next day. And I got reprimanded for that one. But
they were probably going to give you into more trouble for endangering your health than damaging the property.
Oh yeah, no, it was about, yeah, they were concerned with me. My dad called me an idiot. So funny though,
because you'd be more concerned about hiding the damage and be like, "Oh no, honestly, it's fine. Don't worry about me either. Like I'm good." And they've had this experience where they're probably worried for your life at that point in time. So yeah, it's incredible, but it definitely speaks to your personality to be like getting back to growth mode and improvement again.
Imagine the irony if my parents, you know, thought they would lose me to a brain tumor, my life was spared, but then I died under a bench press. That would not
awful.
Yeah, that would not be
so bad. But I'm really curious, how did you progress from there? Because I like, if you look at the physical specimen that you are now, a lot of people would have been maybe derailed by that level of experience, but clearly not you.
I not only wanted to get back to where I was, I wanted to go beyond where I was prior. I wanted to prove to myself that what I had gone through wasn't going to debilitate me or disable me in any way looking forward. And so I had heard about this through the newspaper. I had heard about this National Physical Fitness Championship that the United States Marine Corps hosts in San Diego at their barracks. And I set out to, over the course of approximately speaking the next year, I don't remember how long exactly it was, to get back into great shape and to qualify for that. And I did. I qualified for the National Physical Fitness Championships. And I came in seventh place nationally. And for me, that was an enormous accomplishment to go from, you know, prior to that, I was weightlifting, and I was, you know, always setting my own personal goals. And I was running track. Prior to that, I was playing football, American football, that is. But I never other than like getting some medals for track and, you know, always challenging myself, I had never done something like to that degree, right? Like at the national scale and placing. And that's something that it was a big accomplishment for me. I was also proud to bring some of my classmates with me. So I motivated some classmates that were just in really good shape, but didn't necessarily have the drive to go themselves. And I you know, started training with them, and I inspired them. Some of them I remember at least one of them had never even flown on an airplane before, and others had never been to California. And so I raised money from our neighbors and from the school, and, you know, we were just collecting the money to support the trip. And I was proud to also be able to bring my peers, my friends along with me, and for them to have that experience too.
Yeah, you would definitely have a story and an energy that would draw people towards you. And I know some of my close friends that have maybe had traumatic experiences, one not incredibly dissimilar to yourself. A lot of people are drawn towards him as a little bit of a leader because of what he's gone through and what he's overcome. And I think people are naturally drawn to those that have gone through hardship and come out the other side, not just level or equal, but leveled up. And they, I don't want to say be on their coattails, but kind of follow in their slipstream and be like, oh wow, if Chris can recover from this and train as hard and get to a national championship, then really a perspective, massive thing, I can put in the work in my own training as well and maybe try and accomplish something, whether it's of the same level or in the same domain, great. But if not, just something in their own field they can push towards.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, of course there are limitations to this, but for the most part, anyone could have done what I had done, right? Like, there's nothing specific about me. It's not like my genetics make me, you know, more capable of this than others. In fact, if you consider my genetics, first of all, the fact that I got a brain tumor in the first place, like, that's not the most ideal, right? Second, I've looked at my genetics and I have a number of genes that give me a high propensity for obesity, which runs in my father's side of the family. And so my expectation is that if I wasn't physically active and I wasn't taking care of my health, I would be like the other members of my family who gained a lot of weight. And I would not be in these championships, right? So it's not something that, like, I have some sort of, you know, genetic advantage to be able to perform at this level. No, it's really just having the drive and the dedication and pushing yourself. And I say that to empower your listeners, that it's something that you could do too, if you wanted to, whatever that goal might be.
Yeah, it's really admirable. When did your passion for entrepreneurship and business start to overlap with longevity and health? Because I know you've had a number of different startups over the year. One in particular, we maybe get onto when it comes to the social media world and events, etc. But I'd love to understand when you were able to turn your passion in from health, fitness, longevity, reversing aging into the business that we get to enjoy today as well.
Yeah, it took a while. So it's only been now 5 going on 6 years since I was able to focus on longevity, which is like at the core of my passion, right? Which it took me a while to even understand that it was my passion. Like, I had this experience as a teenager, but I had no idea what longevity science was, longevity medicine was. And for the most part, it didn't really exist yet, right? So we had geroscience, like, let's study aging, let's study old people and what changes for old people. But there's been a dramatic shift in the perspective of, rather than let's just study what goes wrong when people are older, let's study why people get older in the first place. And so that transformation, that transition is much newer, probably, I don't know, maybe 12, 15 years old right now. And so that would mean not until like my mid-20s was it really turning into an area of scientific inquiry. And even back then, it wasn't that well respected. About 10 years ago, I came across a scientific paper in a prestigious scientific journal called Cell. And that paper was called The Hallmarks of Aging. That paper was an epiphany moment for me when I read that, because it basically cataloged the different biological causes of aging that we, at least at that point, understood so far. And at that point, there were 9. We now, those same authors republished that study this year in 2023. Now there's 12 known biological causes of aging. These are things like loss of proteostasis, cellular senescence, mitochondrial dysfunction, stem cell deterioration, and so on. So there's a total of 12 of these. And what made this really impactful for me was, as I mentioned earlier, like, having gone through that brain tumor experience, I never wanted to go through an experience like that again. And whenever I would follow some sort of health intervention, I would always have in the back of my mind, is what I'm doing good for this short-term goal and for the long-term as well? Or can this come back to bite me in the long-term, right? You mentioned bodybuilding before, like, obviously different types of hormones and steroids and so on are going to be good for the short-term goal of bodybuilding, but they're not good for long-term health, right? Increase the risk of disease and death and so on. But that applies to many other things as well. things that might be good for focusing better on your schoolwork or your professional work, like things like Adderall, for example. It applies to lifestyle interventions, like
recreational drugs, etc. Absolutely, yeah,
exactly. So it applies to a lot of things. And so I always had this question in my mind. So with this paper, I finally had this lens through which I could look at all of these different interventions and lifestyle advice and ask the question, even if there wasn't adequate research, I could then use critical reasoning to decide whether this was going to be favorable for stem cells and mitochondria and et cetera, or is it going to be unfavorable? And I was then able to weed out a number of things that the medical establishment or even the wellness world suggests you do with this new perspective. And so from there, I started to attend different biological conferences. So I was trying to learn as quickly as I could. I was the only non-PhD or MD in these conferences, but I was absorbing so
much. You've been living it though, which is huge. And yeah, that's one of the things that I find so relevant. Like, I've had a lot of academic guests on the podcast, but all of them are caveated by the fact that they must have had some sort of real world experience. I don't want a PhD who's sat behind a desk all day and like looks like a bag of potatoes. Like I'm not going to take your advice on health and wellness if you've not been the man in the arena, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. And what you'll oftentimes find, and I work with plenty of scientists now in my role at Novos, is that oftentimes scientists are just highly specialized. They're hyper-focused on this very narrow domain. But then you ask them questions that apply to health outside of that domain and they don't know. And so what you need is either a scientist who is more of a generalist or somebody who has had this passion because it's in their own lifestyles, for example, or they're just somebody who just loves knowledge so much that they're constantly curious and they're trying to learn as much as they can outside of their domain because it will better inform their domain. When you have people like that, then you get this holistic perspective of health, but they are few and far between, believe it or not.
And that's why it needs like an entrepreneurial practical mind to draw it and build it all together, because you cannot just have the academia and the science. You need to have the application and the real world implications of it. And we were speaking before we hit record about longevity having, albeit it's a very new term, as you were explaining there, probably in the last 10 years, people would have in the general population would have even heard the term,
right,
or understand what it might potentially mean. But it does have some connotations of like quite extreme interventions because of some of the social media content creators that are most well known in the space are doing things that seem out of reach. How damaging do you think that is to the cause of promoting genuine longevity?
Yeah. By the way, that's my dog behind me. It's not like hair growing from my neck as we're speaking. But
yeah, geez. Don't worry. Well, that's good. That's good for your happiness, and longevity is so important it from is. That perspective and company too.
It is. Yeah. She brings a lot of happiness to me. Yeah. What I'd say is that, you know, the press loves to cover the extremes, right? Like the crazy things people are doing because people love to read about crazy, unusual things. And in this social media world where we're constantly stimulated and looking for a dopamine fix, how else are you going to do it than reporting on crazy things that people are doing? So it makes sense why this is making its way through the news cycle and why it's, you know, becoming so, you know, well covered,
prevalent
and prevalent. Yeah. But I'd say that first of all, it practically all that is being covered is not necessary for the sake of longevity. Longevity is much more accessible and achievable than what the mainstream press would have you believe, right? So the press is talking about billionaires and centimillionaires who are either backing biotech companies that are going to do crazy things like DNA modification and cellular reprogramming and so on. Okay, that might happen, but that's years from now, probably decades from now. So that we can set that aside for a moment. And then they also cover very wealthy people who are spending millions of dollars a year on their own testing, and then they're getting blood transfusions from younger people, or they're taking combination of androgenic hormones like testosterone and DHEA and HGH, as well as feminine hormones like estradiol, mixing them all together, diabetic drugs, organ transplant drugs. I mean, you go down the list, all in one single person. There's an explanation for it. There's a reason for it, which we can't neglect. There is scientific research that looks at each one of these things that are being utilized and their effect on different animal species, typically mice, and their ability to extend lifespan. So it doesn't come out of nowhere. There is a foundation in scientific research for these interventions. The question is simply, number one, are you actually causing more harm than good by mixing all of these things together? Biology is incredibly complex. There's so many different biological pathways that these different drugs function through. And unless you're taking a very meticulous, careful approach to these different interventions, you run a high risk that you might overdo it on this pathway, blunt this other pathway unintentionally because different drugs interact in ways that you didn't expect, and so on. And so I would say that it's a pretty high risk approach to it. If someone wants to follow it, that's fine. But I don't think the vast majority of people want to go that far with these interventions, not to mention they probably can't because of budgetary requirements and medical prescriptions and the time requirements. Like, we have lives, we have families, we have work. Like, who has the time to do it? So I'm happy to talk about what can be done on a more practical level, because that's what I'm all about, is making longevity accessible, achievable for as many people as possible.
That's exactly why I would want to interview somebody like yourself on this show. And when I've listened to content from the likes of Brian Johnson, I felt it's a little bit exclusionary, because I just cannot understand how I, as a 30-year-old layman with, albeit a relatively good income and a good lifestyle, could even look to implement some of those things. Whereas when I listen to your content, I read your blog, and I see what you're doing at Novos, I can see, like, oh, that's completely tangible, that's within budget, that's within range, that's within my like social life as well. Mm-hmm. Because some of the things that you would maybe want to implement are socially exclusionary as well, which would have other impacts as well. I think it's pretty well documented now that loneliness is a bit of a silent killer.
Yes.
So if you live this, like, if you plow this lone furrow as this, like, angelic nomad, like, chasing longevity and to live to whatever age you want to live to, you might be living like a pretty poor quality of life in the general scheme, like in the general view of things, or even in general, like, happiness, unless this is like an overwhelming mission that is all you care about and fuck everything else.
Right.
Then, well, is the juice worth the squeeze would be the question.
Yeah. Well, so two key points you hit on. The first is, what's the point of quantity of life if you don't have quality of life, right? So you want to make sure you have adequate quality of life to justify extending the quantity of that life. Now, that doesn't mean that you should live a hedonic life where you're doing anything and everything you want at all moments of time. It would no regard for the future. I mean, I personally tend to be more of you know, a stoic perspective on my lifestyle, with you know, occasional moments of hedonism, if you will, right? That dessert on the weekends, or
they feel better because of that, though. I think you're speaking to the right kind of audience who are willing to delay gratification for moments of genuine gratification that they know that they really want, rather than maybe just chasing the next high or the next bump because they got a bit bored or they got a bit uncomfortable in the situation they're in.
Exactly. And then the second point is, it relates to the actual experience of life. So it's kind of digging into that quality of life aspect where, you know, I'm very careful with my sleep, for example, right? So sleep is important for your health, and I'm very strict with when I get to bed, particularly on weekdays. Weekends, I might I go to bed later, of course, but I have a dog. And sometimes that dog will wake me up in the middle of the night and I might need to walk that dog or see what's wrong, right? My expectation is that, like, net, I'm actually in a better place because of that dog. And so, like, do I really want to eliminate that dog from my life for the sake of having a more perfect night of sleep? No, I mean, 95% of the time I do sleep perfectly well. If it's 4 or 5% of the time where there's a disruption, I deal with it and I get back to sleep and I'm fine. And
you control the other controllables, which are so much more within your grasp and would be net negatives. For example, maybe scrolling on your phone later, eating too close to bedtime, or having alcohol, whatever it is that would impact the quality of the sleep. You can control those and they wouldn't add to your life in the way that a dog does, albeit the dog might occasionally be the disrupted to sleep. So I love that as a consideration. I think it's a really wise thing for people to consider. Like, if I'm cutting something out of my life, does it really add that much anyway? Like, I know that I vibrate on a lower frequency. I'm less adherent to my goals and my aims and my ambitions the next day if I've had a poor night's sleep. And one of the biggest correlations between having a poor night's sleep is my phone being in my bedroom before I go to sleep, me maybe being out later or doing things that knock me out of my kind of general like circadian rhythm. And those things often aren't worth like the loss of sleep. So they're much easier for me to agree to eliminate than, say, for example, if I had a dog that woke me one night in 15, and but I love the dog because I get to walk him every day. He's affectionate, he's loving. Like, yeah. There's so much more to it.
So what I'm hearing you say, and this is very relevant to longevity, is that you're a conscientious person. I am as well. I'm very aware of what my goals are, what I want my future life to be, and that by indulging in something today, like maybe staying up later or drinking a glass of alcohol or whatever that might be, is actually going to take me further away from that specific goal. And relatively speaking, I can weigh those in my mind and say that that indulgence of that glass of alcohol and staying up later is not as important and valuable to me as that longer term goal that I'm striving for. What's interesting specifically for longevity is that there have been studies that look at the conscientious character trait and find that conscientious people live longer lives. Now, why is that? There's a number of potential explanations. One is that conscientious people are probably taking fewer crazy risks. They're actually thinking it through first, right? Before they actually do something. So they're less likely to jump off of, you know, that building with a poorly packed parachute or something, right? So in that sense, that applies. But it also goes beyond that. And things like, you know, nutrition and thinking through like the foods that people are eating and being physically fit, educating oneself and like reading and learning. Conscientious people tend to do this more so than unconscientious people, right? And so overall, it's a great trait to have that I'm hearing that you have, not only for like the accomplishment of goals, but it also plays into scientific proof that conscientious people do end up living longer lifespans. And it's not something, I'll end with this, but you know, they do studies of children looking at conscientiousness. And one measure of this is, you know, giving a kid access to dessert and saying like, if you eat this right now, you know, you only get one, but if you wait, you can have two, right? And
it's the marshmallow test that I keep hearing about. Yeah, I completely agree. It's a fantastic measure of people's ability to delay gratification or to seek instant pleasure.
Exactly. Now, that is something that you can actually learn to become more conscientious, right? So if you don't feel like you're particularly conscientious or you struggle with it, you have a hard time with it, it's something that, first of all, as you age and mature, your conscientiousness naturally increases. But second of all, you can actually habituate it more. You have to take small steps.
Fitness taught me a lot, Chris.
Yeah.
Fitness taught me a lot. So being able to shape my body through the training that I do, the sleep that I get, the nutrition that I put into my body, it's great. I really think for me, fitness was a gateway drug to success within my sales career, within my ability to build the podcast, the skill it's got to, the ability to build my body. It plays a massive role, and to become far more conscientious across all those different areas and areas outside of it as well. It was definitely like a learning curve that kind of guided you along that way as well. You were mentioning some of the other areas of what would drive aging. What stands out for you that maybe people wouldn't be aware of?
So let's see. So there's eight different categories that I consider for longevity. One is nutrition. Two is activity, which includes exercise. Three is environment. Four is sleep. Five is stress management. Six is relationships. Seven is supplementation, which we can talk a little bit about why it is actually more important than some people might think. And then 8 is testing, to make sure that everything that you're doing is actually trending in the right direction. So
can I ask you about stress then? Because as somebody that has had numerous startups and is currently running what would be considered a startup, albeit it's your business, so you're the entrepreneur, that is considered by many to be one of the most stressful environments you could work within. And yet, if we haven't mentioned it yet, you've managed to reverse your aging by around 30%, which is incredible considering you're 39 years old. You have the biological age of a 26-year-old. That's a remarkable statistic. But when you consider that's been done in an environment where, one, you had a brain tumor at a very young age, but two, you are in a relatively high pressure pursuit of building a successful business. A lot of people would be surprised by that.
Yeah. Well, so first I'll explain why stress is relevant from a biological perspective to aging. So when we're stressed, there's two different forms of stress. You've got short-term stressors that can be hormetic stressors, and then you've got long-term chronic stressors. A short-term hormetic stressor is something that makes you stronger than before. So exercise is a great example of a hormetic stressor. You inflict stress upon your muscles and your heart, and then after your body recovers, it comes back and repairs itself to be even stronger next time. And that's how you build bigger muscles or you gain in your cardiovascular capacity, right? That's a hormetic stressor. A long-term chronic stressor could be something like financial troubles or toxic relationship, right? Or just the wrong psychological mindset on things, right? Perceiving things in the wrong way that causes undue anxiety and stress. What happens when this is chronically occurring is you're disrupting what's called the cortisol circadian rhythm. And when you disrupt the cortisol circadian rhythm, you're then actually going to impact what's called the glucocorticoid receptors on inflammatory cells. And what ends up happening is that these inflammatory cells, you get more and more of them, they become more activated. And you then launch this chronically inflamed state. And as most of your listeners probably know, inflammation is a root cause of many, many illnesses, right? It starts at disease, that inflammation. Yeah. And so that's how it plays its role in disease and poor health and ultimately biological aging and so on. How do you avoid that? It's a great question. It's not a simple, there's no simple solution to it, right? It's not like I could say, well, eat this food and now you'll avoid stress. It's a process. It's a mindset. And there's a number of different things you can do. One thing that I found to be very helpful for myself was meditation. I got into meditation more than a decade ago. I had a startup venture that was doing very well, but ultimately it failed. And so I went from somebody who was expected to come home with many millions of dollars as someone in their 20s to literally having $0 in my bank account. And for another reason, my apartment was robbed. And so I had nothing to my name. And I became stressed and depressed and so on. And so I started to meditate. And it was really difficult at first. And I saw no benefits whatsoever. I'll be honest. It for the first month, I saw no benefits. But I just kept at it because I heard from people I trusted that it could unlock this other state of consciousness, like a different perspective on things. And I trusted those people enough for me to continue at it. And eventually it came true for me in the sense that I found that meditation was a really good way for me to be able to separate my mind or my observation from myself, right? So I could observe the stressors. I could observe the thoughts that were causing the stress. And then by observing those thoughts, I could also, if I chose to, dig into those thoughts and break them down into their constituent pieces or the narrative I was telling myself that was leading to the stress. And I could then break that narrative and then rewrite that narrative. So meditation enabled me to do this stuff. Most of the time, if you're not meditating, life is just happening. We get our inputs, our brain processes them. We have thoughts that we don't have any control over, and we just react. But when you meditate, you can kind of take a step back from that and observe how your mind is taking these inputs and reacting, and then actually kind of rewrite that process. And so that was tremendously powerful for me. For other people, things like prayer or journaling can be really helpful for stress management, but I find that meditation works best for me. Another thing that I found to be very helpful for stress management is setting everything in context. So when I look back on my experience with a brain tumor or a very difficult event, I lost my mother when I was starting Novos to pancreatic cancer, and I was closer to my mom than anyone else in my life. And so that was a very difficult experience. But I came out the other end. I am here. I have had many happy times. I have a lot of hope for my future. The point is, those difficult experiences, I navigated through them and I ended up on the other end in a healthy place. And so what's to make me think that whatever this stressor is, that I assure you is not as dramatic as losing my mother or having a brain tumor, why should I not be able to get through this? And the answer is, there's no reason I can't. I will get through it and I will be perfectly fine in the end, no matter what happens. And setting that context makes me feel more at ease that this is going to happen. It's just another day. You have the highs and the lows. This might be a low, but I'm going to have a high again, and just give it time and that day will come.
You used the term stoic earlier, and I completely agree that much of what you've said there is derived from a very stoic mindset and outlook on that, while balanced with a lot more of the modern frameworks and tools that we can use as well. And I have tremendous appreciation for your ability to handle, we're going to call it a stressor, but the passing away of a loved one is one of the biggest tests that anyone can face, because life will never truly be the same when you not have that, especially when you're used to the support of your mother as well. So thank you for bringing that to the fore. I think that when somebody is going through those different experiences, and when they're running a company and they're pushing for excellence, as so many people that listen to a podcast like this one are, they're striving for something that's not normal, that's outside of the realms of the average guy that clocks in and works a 9-to-5 that they probably hate. Albeit, interestingly, if they were to do that, that's one of the long-term stresses that you were speaking about there, where you're unfulfilled within your job and you kind of hate what you do. But I think it's fantastic that people can gain immediately potential avenues and frameworks to deal with that, whether it's context and perspective or whether it's meditation, prayer or journaling. One of my recent guests that coaches, she's an executive coach, Dr. Julie Gerner. I don't know if you've ever seen the show Billions, but she's compared to Wendy Rhodes from Billions, who kind of coaches the kind of top hedge funds managers, and she's an absolute living legend. And she was talking about building in the breaks or building in the gaps, because so many people that are busy just run from one thing to the next, and they never give themselves the opportunity to consider what they've just done and what they're about to go and do. And meditation is a forced opportunity to build in a gap, a space in the day where you don't have stimulus, you don't have input, you're left alone with your thoughts, and you're trying to obviously silence them to some extent to make sense of the whole situation. And in the same way, if you're journaling, for me, that's morning and it's night, and it's my opportunity to shut out other inputs, don't look at my phone, don't look at my laptop, don't think about anything else, pen, paper, and just sit within your thoughts. And that's often when I'm the most creative, I'm the most calm, I'm the most able to understand my circumstances, and I'm the least stressed, because I'm planning what I'm going to do the next day. I'm understanding what's happened during this day. And I think there's no surprise that so many of the people I get to speak to on this show have practices like that, like yourself, that enable them to hit the pause button and understand the wider context of life.
Yeah. And when you're journaling like that, you're again being conscientious. You're very aware of your day and what you're trying to derive whatever you can out of your day. But then you're also setting the trajectory looking forward and doing that on a day by day basis, right? Like these micro adjustments that you might be making, or these realizations that you come to that you hadn't come to before, but only because you're sitting still with your thoughts that you come to them. That is a fantastic way to reach your goals and build the life that you're looking to build for yourself.
Yeah, you mentioned micro stressors or like short-term ones like exercise. What does your training plan look like to achieve the level of biological age that you have at 39 to have that 26-year-old biological age? I think it's such a remarkable stat. I just wanted to share it again.
Yeah, sure. So going back to, you know, my teens and my 20s, I was probably pushing myself too hard. Right. So there were many days I would work out in the morning and in the evening, you know, in the morning I might weightlift and in the evening I might go for a long run or whatnot. And I was pushing myself quite hard. And I didn't really appreciate the value of rest and recovery as much as I should have. And I'd say that in my 30s, especially, you know, maybe like around 33, 34, until present, I have really appreciated more that time for rest and recovery. And then also just listening to my body and even looking at quantifiable metrics like, you know, with the Oura Ring or the Apple Watch, things like heart rate variability and seeing if I'm pushing myself too hard or if my sleep wasn't good enough and, you know, just being very aware of all of that. So that's one thing that's significantly different from my 20s to present. And I think a lot of people neglect that aspect of health is like listening to your body and not pushing yourself too hard. But when you are recovered, then pushing yourself hard enough. So my training plan is I don't weightlift as much as I used to. I used to weightlift 6 days a week, roughly. And now I'm weightlifting typically 3, maybe 4 days per week. I'm doing cardio in one form or another 6 days per week. But on a handful of those days, it's actually just a low heart rate zone, like zone 2 cardio, right? So basically the way that my week looks is Monday, I'll do chest and triceps and shoulders, a light shoulder workout because I hit them again on Friday. Wednesday, I'll do back and biceps and deadlifts. Friday, I will do shoulders, but then I'll also hit chest, triceps, back, biceps again. But not as intense, right? It's just making sure that I'm not going too long.
Accumulate some volume. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then on each of those lifting days, prior to lifting, I'll do 25 to 30 minutes of zone 2 cardio. So it's nice and easy. It's building up my excuse me, my aerobic capacity. And that's 3 days. So then on Tuesday, so today is Tuesday, I went for a longer run and more intense run. So I'll go into zone 4 cardio, zone 5 sometimes, where I might do some like some sprints in there and then walk it off and then a sprint. So I'll do intervals. So that's on Tuesdays. On Thursdays, I'll do bicycling, especially because my legs are a little bit sore from the deadlifts the day before on Wednesday. So I'll do bicycling and then I might do again some intervals on the bicycle ride as well. And that's typically in around zone 3 cardio. Then on Saturday, that's my real running day. And that's when I will go longer and harder than any of the other days. And then Sunday is a recovery day. So even if I'm itching to do some workout, I typically resist the urge because again, I need to respect the recovery phase. So on Sundays, it'll be just like, you know, walking. I'll still get a lot of calories in, like maybe 600-700 calories burns from a lot of walking, but I'm not pushing my body.
What is it that brought you to this split? Because I know in the past you've powerlifted and you've deadlifted like, I don't know, 240 kilos or something crazy like that, which was like, what, 3x body weight or something silly. But it's really interesting that you've maybe moved slightly away from that from like a longevity perspective.
Yeah. So, you know, the last thing I want to do is like herniate a disc or something. Right. And like, as I'm getting older, like the chances of that happening are higher. Now, of course, like, you know, having a younger biological age, I shouldn't necessarily think of it the same way as a typical 39 or 40 year old would think about it. But nonetheless, like I don't want to put too intense of a stressor, on my bones and my discs and so on. So, yeah, you're right. I did go from, so I had set a goal for myself when I turned 30. I said earlier with the brain tumor example that I wanted to challenge myself and prove to myself that I could do more than I ever did. So when I was turning 30, I wanted to prove to myself that I could do more than I ever did in my teens and 20s. So I set a goal to achieve the Guinness Book of World Records for most pull-ups in 60 seconds, which unfortunately my video submission wasn't accepted, so I didn't get the title, but I did outdo the record. So I'm trying to remember the exact number. I think it may have been like 43 was the max in 60 seconds.
I've read that you got over 50 in training before as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the training session, I think it was 52 was my personal best. And then for the official submission, I think I got 47 or 48. So I had outdone it, but the video wasn't accepted. So I didn't get the title. But as far as I'm concerned, like I proved to my, I did more pull-ups than I ever did in my life, right? At that period, at 30 years old. So I was very happy with that. And then right after that, I went into deadlifting and trying to set the goal to triple my body weight. So I weighed 175 pounds and I hit 525 pounds. While this wasn't smart, but while in 2 days into a water only fast. So, talk about extreme, like some, we were talking about people going to extremes earlier. Like that's my version of an extreme. It's not like taking,
sometimes we have to lean into that. Yeah. I appreciate that in your personality and your energy, but it's interesting that because of these extreme feats and goals, of course you would have put your body through an element of stress. A lot of that stress would have been recoverable and wouldn't have an impact in your longevity, but you've maybe moved away from that for like the longer term, I guess.
Yeah. So I still, don't get me wrong, I still push myself hard. When I am weightlifting, I am still lifting heavy weight and I'm going to near failure. And, I do have a very good mind muscle connection where, like having done this since I was 12 years old, I know how to push my muscles beyond what,
you know, what RPE 9 feels like exactly, like whereas so many people have no idea what failure looks like. There was a famous Jeff Nippard video that I watched maybe like 8-9 years ago, and it was like the number of people that were like, oh, here's like 50 kilos on bench, do as many reps you can, and they assumed they would get like, I don't know, 20 for argument's sake, and they got like 35, and you're like, this is why you're not growing in the gym at all, because you're going nowhere near like not even like 80% of like your max. And it's funny how many people don't realize quite what they're body's capable of as well.
Exactly. I agree with that. And to that point, I still have that in my training, right? So I am still pushing myself very hard, which I think a lot of people don't push themselves, to your point. They don't push themselves as hard as they actually could. You need to have that experience and have felt it before, and the self-discipline and the desire to push yourself that hard. So I do it with the weightlifting. I do it with the running too. Like I will, if I'm doing sprints, for example, I will push myself as hard as I can, where after the 60 seconds, I do feel nauseous, like I want to vomit. I don't push myself far enough to vomit, but I feel like I want to. And then that minute or two, I'm recovering, I'm getting back to a good place. So I am really pushing myself to the edge with these things. But again, I'm letting myself then recover and get back to a good place again.
That's really important. Like it's the element of like when I'm training, I'm training. When I'm resting, I'm resting. Yes. And there's a clear separation from that. So when you're training, it's go time and I'm going to what I know I'm capable of, and I'm staying just shy of like totally like wrecking myself, but I'm recovering again, so the next session I can go hard and fulfill whatever the aim of this particular training session is. And I think that's so important.
Very quickly, and I also then look at objective markers. So I'll look at my VO2 max, for example, right? I'll look at how many reps I can do on pull-ups and dips, or how much weight I can put up for 12 reps on a bench press, and how much I'm deadlifting for 12 reps and so on, right? So like I'm still watching these things, but as opposed to trying to do one rep at 525 pounds where I might like pull a muscle or, herniate a disc, I'd rather now do 400 pounds, which is still very heavy, but do that for 12 reps rather than one at 525, if that makes sense.
Exactly. And albeit you mentioned you're not doing things from like a vain perspective, but you've built a fantastic physique, and my training is very similar. I couldn't tell you what my one rep max is, couldn't tell you what my three rep max is, but I can tell you what I can get for 12 reps, and I can tell you why it makes my back look thicker and more developed, because I can do it. Or I can add a 10 kilo weight for pull-ups and do 10 to 12 reps for 3 to 4 sets. Like there's a lot to be said for being strong versus body weight.
Yeah.
For multiple reps over and over again from a hypertrophy perspective, and your physique will thank you for that.
Yeah. And I do emphasize calisthenics a lot too, which I didn't mention, but not only weightlifting, but calisthenics I enjoy doing.
Yeah. I always say to friends, like, show me somebody that's really good at pull-ups that doesn't have an aesthetic back.
Right.
You can't, yep. Because you'll have the V taper, you'll have the shaper in the rhomboids or in the lats, and it'll look good from that perspective. So if people are purely like thinking about it from a vanity perspective, it's quite good to be good at these movements.
Yes.
From that perspective, but it's great from that as well. And I've seen some longevity information that like hanging, like grip strength is one of a great predictor for like health outcomes. So if you can't hang for a minute and hold your body weight, that's actually massively increases the chance of you having a number of different inflammatory diseases, because it tends to correlate between like your grip strength and your ability to live for like a beyond the average lifespan.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there, you know, grip strength is one of the more common markers for mortality risk. And, you know, another is gait, looking at somebody's gait. Another is the sit stand test. Like, can you, you know, get up from sitting down without using any touch points, or ideally just one touch, like touching your hand to the ground and then standing up? The less the better, right? And the more you do, the higher your chances of mortality at any given point in time. But when it comes to grip strength, there's also, you know, the debate of how much of that is actually based on, you know, like your aging, so to speak, versus people who might just be in better physical shape because they have been exercising and taking care of themselves for longer. Now, nonetheless, it does predict the likelihood of mortality, right? But it might actually largely be because of people who are exercising. Yeah.
There's a correlation, because somebody's diligent about their health, exactly. They're also diligent about their ability to have good grip strength. We can't mention training without diet, of course. What does a longevity diet look like for you, Chris?
So the most scientifically proven diet for the best health outcomes in terms of both chronic illnesses of aging, like cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and so on, as well as for lifespan, is the Mediterranean diet. Now, we at my company, Novos, we've taken the Mediterranean diet and we've kind of upgraded it. So 90% of it is the same. We took that as the foundation, but there are certain areas, excuse me, like, for example, the amount of grains that they have and reducing those somewhat and incorporating more mushrooms, for example, which have a lot of health benefits to them, more vegetables in the diet, eliminating as much dairy as possible. Cheese is less of a concern because of the fermentation process, but nonetheless, reducing dairy more so. You know, it's interesting, a lot of people aren't aware of this, but dairy, milk specifically, aside from the concerns that like it has a number of hormones in it, and that dairy is typically for every animal species, it's only given during birth, right, to nurture a baby. But no animals in adulthood are still drinking milk except for humans. And there's probably good reason for that, including the hormonal effects. But beyond that, there's a specific molecule within milk. It's called galactose. Galactose is a molecule, and I'm not saying lactose, it's galactose, right? Galactose is a specific molecule that is shown in scientific studies to accelerate aging. In fact, sometimes scientists will use galactose in mice intentionally to speed up the aging of the mouse, right? So we get this in every serving of milk. When you ferment that and you create cheeses, for example, a lot of that galactose is removed. Not 100% of it. There's still some that remains, but a lot of it is removed. I personally don't drink milk anymore. I do have some other forms, alternative forms like hemp milk sometimes and stuff like that. But I do have some cheese. I'm not like completely against cheese, but you know, I'll have some pizza that has cheese. I'll have some pasta that has some cheese, but I'm not going crazy eating like, you know, entire bricks of cheese every day. So there are all of these different tweaks. You can learn about them on our website, novoslabs.com/diet. You can see, we have a poster there. We have some of the rules for it. And then there's a number of articles on our website. If you just search for diet with the little magnifying glass in the top corner, you can find other articles about diet.
A huge amount of what you focused on there is around whole foods, when I've read your website as well. And yes. I come from a generation slightly younger than you, Chris, where we moved away from like clean eating for aesthetics and bodybuilding to if it fits your macros. And while that was helpful to free yourself maybe from some elements of like disordered eating or like being like terrified of like certain food groups, it definitely led to like a lot more junk and processed foods creeping its way into what was previously quite a nutrient dense whole food diet, albeit the title was like clean eating. And it went too far. And I know that my gut health during that period was quite poor. I know that my ability to concentrate and focus was poorer when I was eating lesser quality foods, albeit aesthetically, I largely looked the same. And I find that really interesting how we've kind of moved the dial away from that. And so many of the conversations I'm having in more recent times are on the elements of like whole foods that we should be looking to have.
Yeah. So I completely skipped over that because, you know, in my mind, it's something that's been integrated into my life for so long now, eating whole foods, but I keep forgetting that like people are typically eating hyper processed foods that are stripped of their nutrients and are calorically dense as opposed to nutritionally dense.
Hyper palatable as well.
Exactly. And when I was younger, the bodybuilding diet was basically chicken breast, broccoli, and rice, right? So I guess we've moved away from that. But to that point, I have an article on my personal website. So I have a blog. It's non-commercial. It's slowmyage.com. And I have an article called Diet and Nutrition, How I Extend My Health Span, Lifespan, and Slow My Aging. One of the things that I talk about in there is nutrient insufficiencies. So there's a difference between a nutrient deficiency and a nutrient insufficiency. So a nutrient deficiency is according to like the recommended daily allowance. This is what the government says to avoid a short-term disease like scurvy. You don't get enough vitamin C, you get scurvy. So they set their expectations at this like very low level to avoid some short-term disease. They don't do long-term studies over the course of 5 years, 10 years, 20 years and see like what the ideal dosage is for these nutrients to avoid disease and to live as long as you can in a healthy way. So that's where nutrient insufficiency comes in. And a nutrient insufficiency is defined by looking at the healthiest people in each age cohort. So let's look at 30-year-olds. How much potassium or vitamin A or B6 are they taking in? Healthiest 50-year-olds, healthiest 60-year-olds, all the way up, right? And then looking at what the typical person is actually taking in and then deducing from that what they are insufficient in, how much more of something they should get, right? And what there's a study called the NHANES study in the United States where they looked at over 16,000 people's diets and looked at what they were, what the nutrient composition of these diets were. And what they concluded based on nutrient insufficiency is that 99% of people were insufficient in potassium. 95% were insufficient in vitamin D, which you can get from the sun, but also from diet. 94% were insufficient in vitamin E and tocopherols and tocotrienols. What else? 92% were deficient in choline, which is the forgotten B vitamin. This is what you get from egg yolks primarily, but other foods contain choline as well. So you go down the list and you've got all of these insufficiencies. And so to your point about people eating these hyperpalatable, nutrient-strapped, calorically dense foods, they might be able to, from a macronutrient level, achieve a bodybuilding goal of building more muscle and looking slim, but they're neglecting what's actually happening on a organ level and on a cellular level and even on a DNA level and mitochondrial level within their bodies from being deficient in these nutrients. And they may or may not notice it. Like, you know, this, gut issues from it. I've also, when I was younger, noticed gut issues from not eating the right foods. It can manifest as acne. It can manifest as poor concentration. It could be high levels of anxiety, difficulties coping with
stress. I remember reading in one of your articles that you had an allergic reaction to nuts, which was almost fatigue, which yes. I find fascinating. And I suspect there's a lot of people out there that maybe feel like sluggish after lunch if they have a particular sandwich or a particular thing in the sandwich. And best believe it's probably your gut telling you that your body does not want to deal with that.
You know, it's funny you say that because last weekend I went out to dinner with a friend of mine and we decided to share a dessert and he got this dessert that had pistachio nuts in it and hazelnuts. And I was like, he was apologizing because he had forgotten what I had said about the nuts. I was like, yeah, it's all right. Let me give it a try. So I had a handful of them and it was nighttime already. So I went to sleep, but the next day I was more fatigued than I've been in months and I had to take a nap in the middle of the afternoon. And so, you know, even I was thinking like, hey, maybe like it was a gut issue, like permeable gut and maybe like that's been repaired and now I can eat it. Nope. Still the same issue. So we have food sensitivities. Not every single person does, but a large number of people have sensitivities to specific foods. The best way to figure out if you do is do an elimination diet. You get rid of the most common allergens from your diet. You go strict for a few weeks. Then you slowly add those foods back in. And you see if your body reacts differently to any one of those. And that's how you can really determine if you have a specific food sensitivity.
You can pinpoint. I'm really glad you mentioned the insufficiency versus deficient, because it's so relevant. The people that are listening to this are not looking to just get to baseline. They're looking to go from baseline to excellent.
Yeah.
And so much of the health recommendations that we have is for moving people from illness to health, but we're looking to go from like health to wellness, or like betterment and feel great. And I think that's why people listen to a podcast like this one and people like yourself, Chris, because there's an ability to point out that, okay, the RDA for vitamin D might be 400 IU. Well, actually I supplement with like 5,000 or 6,000 or whatever it is because of the benefits of it beyond that. And there's particularly with vitamin D, there doesn't appear to be too many challenges. If you get almost too much, your body just kind of deals with it, whereas for certain things, like more is not always more, it would be the phrase I would use.
Yeah, well, yeah, so you're speaking of in particular fat soluble vitamins, for example. An overdose on them can accumulate in the body, vitamin A, vitamin E, to some degree vitamin D, but yeah, you do have a lot of wiggle room with vitamin D, vitamin K, and then also with certain minerals as well, right? So obviously too much sodium is going to lead to higher blood pressure, water retention, and so on. And longer term can cause cardiovascular complications and stroke. But then also the opposite is true. If too much potassium, which almost definitely you don't have too much potassium, again, because 99% of people didn't have enough potassium.
It's funny you mentioned bananas earlier. You need to eat a lot of bananas to get your potassium in.
Yes. But I personally have a hack for potassium. So I use something called light salt instead of regular sodium salt. So light salt, the brand Morton's, which is very commonly available, sells light salt. It's 50% sodium, 50% potassium. So they're two different forms of salts. And I use that typically on my food, except maybe after a long sweaty workout, maybe I use regular salt because you lose more salt through your sweat. Sorry, I got to be clear here. More sodium salt through your sweat than potassium salt through your sweat, right? Both of them are salts. When people say salt, they usually mean table salt, which is sodium salt. That's why there's the ambiguity there. But this 50-50 light salt is good to put on your food to change the ratio, up the percentage of potassium relative to the sodium in your diet. And if you look at historically what people were consuming, especially hunter-gatherers, like they were getting far more potassium even than the FDA recommends. I mean, they were getting 7 grams, 8 grams, 9 grams of potassium a day. Today, you'd be lucky to find someone who's getting 3 grams of potassium a day, right? And they're getting that much or more sodium, whereas historically people were only getting a couple of grams of sodium a day, right? So it's completely distorted, flipped upside down.
Understanding these things is so empowering, and the solutions that people like yourself and your company are putting forward is such a great tool for people to move forward with. And I feel like we've scratched the surface. We haven't even had the time to really go deep into supplements as well, Chris, but I'm hugely appreciative of your work. The value and the free content you've got out there is absolutely incredible as well. If people want to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
So I have my personal blog, and I'm also on Twitter and Instagram as Slow My Age. And then Novos is my company. We didn't mention this before, but we are a public benefit corporation. We do everything we can to try to make longevity accessible and achievable for as many people as possible. We have patent pending formulations. We have the world's best biological age testing kit that we license from Columbia and Duke University. And then we have all of this free knowledge and technology tools that we are rolling out for people to use. And they can find that at novoslabs.com and on all of the social networks as Novos Labs.
The depth of it's absolutely incredible, Chris. And like I say, hugely impressed by what you're putting out there. And I'm sure the listeners are going to absolutely love it as well. It's all going to be linked in the show notes. Thank you to you, Chris. And a big thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.